yet always in the best of tempers. The prince whom Maggie saw now, sitting in his dimly lit castle, was nothing like that. His face was pale and his skin hung in wrinkled folds, as if it had once belonged to a larger man. Grief had melted the fat from his limbs, and his expression was fixed, as if it had frozen on the day when they brought him the news of his son's death. Only his eyes still showed his horror and bewilderment at what life had done to him. Apart from his grandson and the guard standing silent in the background, there were only two women with him. One kept her head humbly bent like a maidservant, although she wore a dress fit for a princess. Her mistress stood between the prince of size and the empty chair on which the plumed helmet lay. Violante, thought Maggie. The Adderhead's daughter, and Cosimo's widow. Her ugliness, as people called her. Finolio had told Maggie about her, emphasizing the fact that she was indeed one of his creations, but that he had never intended her to be more than a minor character, the unhappy child of an unhappy mother and a very bad father.
It's absurd to marry her to Cosimo the Fair, Finolio had said, but as I told you, this story's getting out of hand.
Violante wore black, like her son and her father-in-law. Her dress, too, was embroidered with pearly tears, but their precious luster didn't suit her particularly well. Her face looked as if someone had drawn it on a stained piece of paper with a pencil too pale for the purpose, and the dark silk of her dress made her look even plainer. The only thing you noticed about her face was the purple birthmark, as big as a poppy, disfiguring her left cheek. When Maggie and Finolio came across the dark hall, Violante was just bending down to her father-in-law, speaking to him quietly. The prince's expression did not change, but finally he nodded, and the boy slipped down from his chair in relief. Finolio signaled to Maggie to stay where she was. His head respectfully bent, he stepped aside, and unobtrusively signaled to Maggie to do the same. Violante nodded to Finolio as she passed him, her head held high, but she didn't even look at Maggie. She ignored the stone statues of her dead husband, too. Her ugliness seemed to be in a hurry to escape this dark hall, in almost as much of a hurry as her son. The maid who followed her passed so close to Maggie that the servant girl's dress almost touched her. She didn't seem much older than Maggie herself. Her hair had a reddish tinge, as if firelight were falling on it, and she wore it loose, as only the women among the strolling players usually did in this world. Maggie had never seen lovelier hair.
Well, you're late, Finolio,
said the Prince of Sighs as soon as the doors had closed behind the women and his grandson. His voice still came out of his mouth with an effort, like every fat man's.
Did you run short of words?
I won't run short until my last breath, my prince, replied Finolio with a bow.
Maggie wasn't sure whether to copy him. In the end, she just decided on a clumsy curtsy. At close quarters, the prince's size looked even more fragile. His skin resembled withered leaves, the whites of his eyes like yellowed paper.
Who's the girl?
He asked, bending his weary gaze on her.
Your maid? Too young to be your lover, isn't she?
Maggie felt the blood rise to her face.
Your grace, what an idea, said Finolio, dismissing it and putting an arm around her shoulders. This is my granddaughter who's come to visit me. My son hopes I shall find her a husband, and what better place for her to look for one than at the wonderful party you're giving today?
Maggie blushed more than ever, but she forced herself to smile.
Ah, you have a son, do you?
The voice of the prince's sigh sounded envious, as if he begrudged any of his subjects the luck of having a son.
It's not wise to let your children go too far away, he murmured, without taking his eyes off Maggie. Only too likely that they may never come back.
Maggie didn't know where to look.
I'll be going home soon, she said. My father knows that, I hope, she added in her mind.
Yes, yes, of course, she'll be going back when the time comes.
Finolio's voice sounded impatient. But now we come to the reason for my visit. He took the roll of parchment so carefully sealed by Rosencrantz from his belt and climbed the steps to the princely chair with his head respectfully bent. The Prince of Sighs seemed to be in pain. He tightened his lips as he leaned forward to take the parchment, and cool though it was in the hall, sweat stood out on his forehead. Maggie remembered what Minerva had said. "This prince of ours will sigh and lament himself to death." Finolio seemed to think so, too. "Aren't you feeling well, my prince?" he asked with concern.
"No, I'm not," snapped the prince, annoyed. "Unfortunately, the adder had noticed it today, too."
He leaned back, sighing, and struck the side of his chair with his hand.
"Tullio!"
A servant clad in black, like the prince, shot out from behind the chair. He would have looked like a rather short human being, but for the fine fur on his face and hands. Tullio reminded Maggie of the brownies in Eleanor's garden who had turned to ashes, although he clearly had more of the human being about him.
"Go and get me a minstrel. One who can read," ordered the prince. "He can sing me Fenolio's song."
And Tullio scurried off as willing as a puppy. "Did you send for Nettle, as I advised?" Finolio's voice sounded urgent, but the prince just waved away the idea angrily.
"Nettle? What for?" "She wouldn't come. Or if she did, it would probably just be to poison me, because I had a couple of oaks felled for my son's coffin. How can I help it if she'd rather talk to trees than human beings? None of them can help me, not Nettle, or any of the physicians, stonecutters and bone-knitters whose evil-smelling potions I've swallowed. No herb grows that can cure grief."
His fingers trembled as he broke Finolio's seal, and all was so still in the darkened hall as he read that Maggie heard the candle flames hiss as the wicks burned down. Almost soundlessly, the prince moved his lips as his clouded eyes followed Finolio's words. "He will awake no more. Oh, nevermore," Maggie heard him whisper. She looked sideways at Finolio, who flushed guiltily when he noticed her glance. Yes, he had stolen the lines, and certainly not from any poet of this world. The laughing prince raised his head and wiped a tear from his clouded eyes.
"Fair words, Finolio," he said bitterly.
"Yes, you know all about those.
But when will any of you poets find the words to open the door through which death takes us?"
Finolio looked around at the statues. He stared at them, lost in thought, as if seeing them for the first time.
"I am sorry, but there are no such words, my prince," he said. "Death is all silence. Even poets have no words once they have passed the door death closes behind us. If I may, then, I would humbly beg your leave to go. My landlady's children are waiting outside, and if I don't catch them again, they may well soon run off with the strolling players, for like all children, they dream of taming bears and dancing between heaven and hell on a tightrope."
"Yes, yes, yeah, go away,"
said the Prince of Sighs, wearily waving his beringed hand.
"I'll send to let you know when I want words again. They're sweet-tasting poison, still. They're the only way to make even pain taste bittersweet for a few moments."
"He will awake no more. Oh, nevermore."
Eleanor would certainly have known who wrote those lines, thought Maggie as she walked back down the dark hall with Finolio. The herbs scattered on the floor rustled under her boots. Their fragrance hung in the cool air, as if to remind the sad prince of the world waiting for him out there. But perhaps it reminded him only of the flowers in the crypt where Cosimo lay. At the door, Tullio came to meet them with the minstrel, hopping and leaping in front of the man like a trained shaggy animal. The minstrel wore bells at his waist and had a lute on his back. He was a tall, thin fellow, with a sullen set to his mouth, and so garishly clothed that he would have put a peacock's tail to shame. "That fellow can actually read, can he?"
Fenelia whispered to Maggie as he pushed her through the door. I don't believe it. What's more, his singing sounds as sweet as the cawing of a crow. Let's be off before he gets his great horsey teeth into my poor lines of verse.
Chapter 22. 10 Years. Dustfinger was leaning against the castle wall, behind the stalls where people were crowding. The aroma of honey and hot chestnuts rose to his nostrils, and high above him went the tightrope walker whose blue figure, from a distance, reminded him so much of Cloud Dancer. He was holding a long pole with tiny birds sitting on it, birds as red as drops of blood. And when the dancer changed direction, stepping lightly, as if standing on a swaying rope was the most natural thing in the world, the birds flew up and fluttered around him, twittering shrilly. The marten on Dustfinger's shoulder looked up at them and licked his lips. He was still very young, smaller and more delicate than Gwyn, not half as likely to bite. And most important of all, he didn't fear fire. Absently, Dustfinger had tickled his horned head. He had caught him behind the stable soon after his arrival at Roxanne's house, when the marten was trying to stalk her chickens, and had called him Jink, because of the way he jinked as he moved, dodging and darting before jumping up over Dustfinger so suddenly that he almost knocked him over. "Are you crazy?" he had asked himself when he lured the animal to him with a fresh egg. "He's a marten. How do you know that it makes any difference to death what name he bears?" But he'd kept Jink all the same. Perhaps he had left all his fears behind in the other world. His fears, his loneliness, his ill fortune. Jink learned fast. He was soon leaping through the flames as if he'd been doing it all his life. It would be easy to earn a few coins with him at the markets, with him and the boy. The marten nuzzled Dustfinger's cheek. Some acrobats were building a human tower in front of the empty platform that still awaited the birthday boy. Farida tried persuading Dustfinger to perform, too, but he didn't want people staring at him today. He wanted to stare himself, see his fill of all he'd been missing for so long. So he was not in Fire Eater's costume either, but wore Roxanne's dead husband's clothes, which she had given him. They had obviously been almost the same size. Poor fellow. Neither Orpheus nor Silvertongue could bring him back from where he was now. "Why don't you earn the money today for a change?" he had asked Farid. The boy had turned first red, and then white as chalk with pride, and shot away into the turmoil. He was a quick learner, only a tiny morsel of the fiery honey, and Farid was talking to the flames as if he'd been born with their language on his tongue. Of course, they didn't yet spring from the ground when the boy snapped his fingers as readily as for Dustfinger himself. But when Farid called to the fire in a low voice, it would speak to him. Condescendingly, sometimes with mockery, but still, it answered him. "Oh, but he is your son," Roxanne had said when Farid had drawn a bucket of water from the well early in the morning, cursing to cool his burned fingers.
"He's not,"
Dustfinger had replied, and had seen in her eyes that she didn't believe him. Before they set off for the castle, he had practiced a couple of tricks with Farid, and Jehan had watched. But when Dustfinger beckoned the boy closer, he ran away. Farid had laughed out loud at him for it, but Dustfinger put his hand over Farid's mouth.
"The fire devoured his father. Have you forgotten?" he had whispered.
Farid bowed his head, ashamed.
How proudly he stood there among the other entertainers.
Dustfinger pushed his own way past the stalls to get a better view. Farid had taken off his shirt as Dustfinger himself sometimes did. Burning cloth was more dangerous than a small burn on the skin, and you could easily protect your naked body against the licking tongues of fire with grease. The boy put on a good act, such a good one that even the traders stared at him spellbound. And Dustfinger took his chance to free a few fairies from the cages where they had been imprisoned, to be sold to some fool as Lucky Charms.
"No wonder Roxanne suspects you of being his father," he told himself. "Your chest swells with pride when you look at him."
Next to Farid, a couple of clowns were exchanging broad jokes. To his right, the Black Prince was wrestling with his bear, but all the same, more and more people stopped to look at the boy standing there playing with fire, oblivious of all around him. Dustfinger watched as Sootbird lowered his torches and looked enviously their way. He'd never learn. He was still as poor a fire-eater as he'd been 10 years ago. Farid bowed, and a shower of coins fell into the wooden bowl that Roxanne had given him. He glanced proudly at Dustfinger, as hungry for praise as a dog for a bone, and when Dustfinger clapped his hands, he flushed red with delight. What a child he still was, even though he had proudly shown Dustfinger the first stubble on his chin a few months ago. Dustfinger was making his way past two farmers haggling over a couple of piglets when the gate to the inner castle opened again. This time not, as before, for the adder head, when Dustfinger himself had only just managed to hide from the piper's searching glance behind a cake stall. No. Obviously, the birthday boy himself was finally appearing at his own festivities, and his mother would accompany the child, with her maidservant. How fast his foolish heart was suddenly beating.
"She has your hair," Roxanne had said. "And my eyes."
The prince's pipers made the most of their big scene. Proud as turkey cocks, they stood there, long-stemmed trumpets held aloft in the air. The strolling players, being their own masters, disapproved without exception of musicians who sold their art to a single lord. In exchange, the pipers were better dressed, not in motley array like the players on the road, but in their prince's colors. For the pipers of the prince of size, that meant green and gold. His daughter-in-law wore black. Cosimo the Fair had been dead for barely a year, but his young widow would certainly have been courted by several suitors already, in spite of the mark, dark as a burn, that disfigured her face. The crowd came thronging around the platform as soon as Violante and her son had taken their seats. Dustfinger had to climb on an empty barrel to catch a glimpse of the maidservant beyond all those heads and bodies. Brianna was standing behind the boy. Despite her bright hair, she was like her mother. The dress she wore made her look very grown up, yet Dustfinger still saw on her face traces of the little girl who had tried to snatch burning torches from his hand, or stamped her foot angrily when he wouldn't let her catch the sparks he brought raining down from the sky.
10 years. 10 years he'd spent in the wrong story. 10 years in which death had taken one of his daughters, leaving behind nothing but memories as pale and indistinct as if she had never lived at all, while his other daughter had grown up, laughing and weeping through all those years, and he had not been there. Hypocrite, he told himself, unable to take his eyes from Brianna's face. Are you trying to tell yourself that you were a devoted father before Silvertongue lured you into his story?
Cosimo's son laughed out loud, his stubby finger pointed first at one, then at another of the entertainers, and he caught the flowers that the women players threw him.
How old was he? 5? 6? Brianna had been the same age when Silvertongue's voice had enticed him away. She'd only come up to his elbow, and she weighed so little that he scarcely noticed when she climbed up on his back. When he forgot time yet again, and stayed away for weeks on end, in places with names she had never heard, she used to hit him with her little fists and throw the presents he brought her at his feet. Then she would slip out of bed the same night to retrieve them all. Colored ribbons as soft as rabbit fur, fabric flowers to put in her hair, little pipes that could imitate the song of a lark or the hoot of an owl. She had never told him so, of course. She was proud, even prouder than her mother. But he always knew where she put the presents. In a bag among her clothes. Did she still have it? She had kept his presence, yes, but they could never bring a smile to her face when he had stayed away for a long time. Only fire could do that, and for a moment. A seductive moment. Dustfinger was tempted to step out of the gaping crowd, take his place among the other entertainers performing tricks for the prince's grandson, and summon fire just for his daughter's sake. But he stood where he was, invisible behind the throng, watching her smooth back her hair with the palm of her hand in the same way as her mother did so often, unobtrusively rubbing her nose and shifting from foot to foot, as if she'd much rather be dancing down there than standing stiffly here.
Eat him, Bear! Eat him up this minute! So he really is back! But do you think he's planning to go and see an old friend?
Dustfinger spun around so suddenly that he almost fell off the barrel where he was standing. The Black Prince was looking up at him, with his bear behind him. Dustfinger had hoped to meet him here, surrounded by strangers, rather than in the strolling players' camp, where there were too many who would ask where he had been. The two of them had known each other since they were the same age as the prince's grandson enthroned in his chair on the platform. The orphaned sons of strolling players, adult before their time. And Dustfinger had missed that black face almost as much as Roxanne's.
So, will he really eat me if I get off this barrel?
Prince laughed. His laughter sounded almost as carefree as in the old days.
Maybe, after all, he's noticed that I really do have a grudge against you for not coming to see me. And didn't you scorch his fur the last time you two met?
Jink crouched on Dustfinger's shoulder as he jumped off the barrel, chattering excitedly in his ear.
Don't worry, the bear doesn't eat your sort,
Dustfinger whispered to him, and hugged the prince as hard as if a single embrace could make up for 10 years.
You still smell more of a bear than a man. Yeah, and you smell of fire. Now tell me, where you been?
The Black Prince held Dustfinger at arm's length, and looked at him as if he could read in his face everything that had happened during his friend's absence.
So, the fire raisers didn't string you up then, as many folks say. You look too healthy for that. What about the other story? That the adder had locked you up in his dankest dungeon? Or did you turn yourself into a tree for a while, as some songs say, a tree with burning leaves deep in the wayless wood?
Dustfinger smiled. I'd like that, but I assure you, even you wouldn't believe the real story. A whisper ran through the crowd. Looking over all the heads, Dustfinger saw Farid, red in the face, acknowledging their applause. Her ugliness's son was clapping so hard that he almost fell off his chair. But Farid was searching the throng for Dustfinger's face. He smiled at the boy, and sensed that the Black Prince was looking at him thoughtfully.
So the boy really is yours, he said. No, don't worry, I'll ask no more questions. I know you like to have your secrets, and I don't suppose that has changed much. All the same, I want to hear the story you spoke of sometime. And you owe us a performance, too. We can all do with something to cheer us up. Times are bad, even on this side of the forest, though it may not seem so today.
Yeah, so I've heard already, and the Otterhead obviously doesn't love you any better than before.
What have you done to make him threaten you with the gallows? Did the bear take one of his stags?
Dustfinger stroked Jink's bristling fur. The marten never took his eyes off the bear.
Oh, believe me, the Adderhead scarcely guesses half of what I do, or I'd be dangling from the battlements of the castle of night long ago.
Oh, yes.
The tightrope walker was sitting on his rope above them, surrounded by his birds and swinging his legs, as if the milling crowd down below was nothing to do with him.
Prince, I don't like that look in your eye, said Dustfinger, looking up at the men walking the rope. You do better not to provoke the Otterhead any more, or he'll have you hunted down just as he's hunted others. And then you won't be safe on this side of the forest either.
Someone was pulling at his sleeve. Dustfinger turned so abruptly that Farid flinched back in alarm.
I'm sorry, he stammered, nodding rather uncertainly to the prince. But Nagi's here, with Fenolio.
He sounded as excited as if he had met the laughing prince in person.
Where?
Dustfinger looked around, but Farid had eyes only for the bear, who had affectionately placed his muzzle on the black prince's head. The prince smiled and pushed the bear's muzzle away.
Where?
Dustfinger repeated impatiently, for Fenolio was the very last person he wanted to meet.
Over there, just behind the platform.
Dustfinger looked the way Farid's finger was pointing. Sure enough, there was the old man, with two children, just as he had first seen him. Silver Tongue's daughter stood beside him. She'd grown tall, even more like her mother. Dustfinger uttered a quiet curse. What were those two after here in his story? They had as little to do with it as he had to do with theirs.
Oh, yes, mocked a voice inside him.
The old man won't see it that way. Did you forget he claims to have created everything here?
They don't want to see him, he told Farid.
Bad luck clings to that old man, and worse than bad luck, too, mark my words.
Is the boy talking about the ink weaver?
The prince came so close to Dustfinger's side that the marten hissed at him.
What do you have against him? He writes good songs.
He writes other things as well.
And who knows what he's already written about you, Dustfinger added in his mind. A few well-chosen words, prince. And you're a dead man.
Farid was still looking at the girl.
What about Maggie? Don't you want to see her either? His voice sounded husky with disappointment. She asked how you were.
Give her my regards, she'll understand. Off you go, then. I can see you're still in love with her. How was it you once described her eyes? Little pieces of the sky?
Fareed blushed scarlet.
Stop it, he said angrily.
But Dustfinger took him by the shoulders and turned him around.
Go on, he said. Give her my regards, but tell her to keep my name out of her magic mouth. Understand?
Fareed cast a last glance at the bear, nodded,
and strolled back to the girl very slowly, as if to show that he wasn't in any hurry to reach her. She was going to great pains herself not to look his way too often as she fidgeted awkwardly with the sleeves of her dress. She looked as if she belonged here, a maid-servant from a not particularly prosperous home, perhaps the daughter of a farmer or a craftsman. Well, her father was indeed a craftsman, wasn't he? If one with special talents.
Perhaps she was looking around rather too freely. Girls here usually kept their heads bent, and sometimes they were already married by her age. Did his daughter Brianna have anything like that in mind? Roxanne hadn't said so.
That boy's good. Better than Sudbird already.
The prince put out his hand to the marten, and withdrew it when Jink bared his tiny teeth.
That's not difficult.
Dustfinger let his eyes wander to Finolio. So, they called him Inkweaver here. How contented he looked. The man who had written Dustfinger's death. A knife in the back, plunged so deep that it found his heart. That was what Finolio had planned for him. Dustfinger instinctively reached to touch the spot between his shoulder blades. Yes, he had read them already, after all, Finolio's deadly words, one night in the other world when he'd been lying awake, trying in vain to conjure up Roxanne's face in his memory.
You can't go back, he had kept hearing Maggie's voice saying those words. One of Capricorn's men is waiting for you in the book. They want to kill Quinn, and you try to help him, so they kill you instead.
He had taken the book out of his backpack with trembling fingers, had opened it and searched the pages for his death. And then he'd read what it said there, in black and white, over and over again. After that, he had decided to leave Gwen behind if he should ever come back here. Dustfinger stroked Jink's bushy tail. No. Perhaps it had not been a good idea to catch another marten.
Hey, what's the matter? You look as if the hangman had given you the nod all of a sudden.
The Black Prince put an arm around his shoulders, while his bear sniffed curiously at Dustfinger's backpack.
The boy must have told you how we picked him up in the forest. He was in a great state of agitation. Said he was here to warn you. And when he said of whom, many of my men's hands went to their knives.
Basta. Dustfinger ran a finger over his scarred cheek.
Yes, he's probably back too.
With his master?
No, Capricorn's dead. I saw him die myself.
The Black Prince put his hand in his bear's mouth and tickled its tongue.
Well, that's good news. And there wouldn't be much for him to come back too, just a few charred walls. Only Nettle sometimes goes there. She swears you can't find better yarrow anywhere else than in Fireraise's old fortress.
Dustfinger saw Finolio glancing his way. Maggie was looking in the same direction, too. He quickly turned his back on them.
We have a camp near there now. You'll remember the old Brownies caves? The prince went on, lowering his voice.
Since Cosimo smoked out the fire raisers, those caves had made good shelter again. Only the stony players know about them. The old and frail, cripples, women tired of living on the road with their children, they can all stay there and rest for a while. I tell you what, the secret camp would be a good place for you to tell me a story. The one that you say so hard to believe. I've often been there for the bear's sake. He gets grouchy when he spends too long between city walls. Roxanne can tell you how to find a place. She knows her way around the forest almost as well as you by now.
I know the old brownie case, said Dustfinger. He had hidden from Capricorn's men there many times, but he wasn't sure that he really wanted to tell the prince about the last 10 years.
6 torches!
Fareed was beside him again, wiping soot off his fingers on his trousers.
I juggled with 6 torches, and I didn't drop one. I think she liked it.
Dustfinger suppressed a smile. Very likely.
Two of the strolling players had drawn the prince aside. Dustfinger wasn't sure whether he knew them, but he turned his back to be on the safe side.
Did you know everyone's talking about you?
Farid's eyes were round as coins with excitement. They're all saying you're back. And I think some of them have recognized you.
Oh, how they... Dustfinger looked uneasily around. His daughter was still standing behind the little prince's chair. He hadn't told Farid about her. It was bad enough having the boy jealous of Roxanne.
They say there never was a fire eater to match you. The other one there, Sootbird, they call him.
Farid put a piece of bread in Jink's mouth.
He asked about you, but I didn't know if you wanted to meet him. He's really bad at it. He doesn't know how to do anything, but he says he knows you. Is that right?
Yes, but all the same, I'd rather not meet him.
Dustfinger turned. The tightrope walker had come down from his rope at last. Cloud Dancer was talking to him and pointing Dustfinger's way. Time to disappear. He would be happy to see them all again, but not here. Not today.
I've had enough of this, he told Farid. You stay and earn us a few more coins. I'll be at Roxanne's if you want me.
Up on the platform, her ugliness was handing her son a gold-embroidered purse. The child put his plump hand into it and threw the entertainers some coins. They hastily bent to pick them out of the dust. But Dustfinger cast a last look at the Black Prince and went away. What would Roxanne say when she heard that he hadn't exchanged a single word with his daughter? He knew the answer. She would laugh. She knew, only too well, what a coward he could be. Chapter 23 Cold and White.
There they were again. Mo felt them coming closer. He saw them even though his eyes were closed. White women. Their faces so pale, their eyes colorless and cold. That was all there was in the world. White shadows in the dark, and the pain in his breast. Red pain. Every breath brought it back. Breathing. Hadn't it once been perfectly easy? Now it was difficult. As difficult as if they had buried him already, heaping earth on his breast, on the pain burning and throbbing there. He couldn't move. His body was useless, a burning prison. He wanted to open his eyes, but his lids weighed down as heavily as if they were made of stone. Everything was lost. Only words remained. Pain. Fear. Death. White words. No color in them. No life. Only the pain was red. Is this death? Mo wondered. This void, full of faint shadows. Sometimes he thought he felt the fingers of the pale women reaching into his agonized breast, as if to crush his heart. Their breath wafted over his hot face, and they were whispering a name, but it was not a name he remembered as his own.
Blue Jay,
they whispered. Their voices seemed to be made of cold yearning. Nothing but cold yearning.
It's easy,
they whispered.
You don't even have to open your eyes. No more pain. No darkness. Stand up, they whispered. It's time to go.
And they entwined their white fingers with his. Their fingers were wonderfully cool on his burning skin. But the other voice wouldn't let him go, indistinct, barely audible, as if it came from far, far away,
It penetrated the whispering. It sounded strange, almost discordant among the whispering shadows. "Be quiet," he wanted to tell it with his tongue of stone. "Be quiet, please. Let me go." For nothing but that voice kept him imprisoned in the burning house that was his body. But the voice went on. He knew it. But where from? He couldn't remember. It was long ago that he had last heard it. Too long ago.
Chapter 24. In Eleanor's Cellar.
"I always have furnished up my cellar more comfortably," thought Eleanor, watching Darius pump up the air mattress he had found behind one of the storage shelves for her. But how could she have guessed that some dreadful day she'd have to sleep down here, while a bespectacled, moon-faced man sat up in her wonderful library with his slobbering dog playing master of the house? The wretched animal had almost eaten the fairy who had slipped out of Orpheus's words. A blue fairy and a lark fluttering in panic against the window panes. That was all that had come out of the book, to replace four people.
"Well, look at that,"
Orpheus had triumphantly announced.
"Two for four. There are fewer and fewer coming out. And one day I'll manage not to let anything out of a book at all."
Conceited pig! As if anyone was interested in who or what came out of the book when Risa and Mortimer had gone. And Mortola. And Basta.
"Quick, Anna, think of something else."
If only she could have hoped that someone useful would soon come knocking on her front door. But unfortunately, such a visitor was highly improbable. She had never had much to do with her neighbors, certainly not since Darius had taken over the care of her books, and Mo and Risa and Maggie had moved in. What more did she need in the way of company? Her nose began to prickle ominously.
"That's the wrong way to think, Eleanor,"
she warned herself, as if she'd been able to think of anything else these last few hours.
"They're all right," she kept telling herself. "You'd have sensed it if anything had happened to them. Wasn't that what all the stories said? You felt it, like a pang in your heart when something happened to someone you loved."
Darius smiled hesitantly at her as his foot went tirelessly up and down on the pump. The air mattress already looked like a caterpillar, a huge, squashed caterpillar. How was she supposed to sleep on that thing? She'd roll off and land on the cold cement floor.
"Darius," she said, "we must do something. We can't simply let them shut us up here one more time."
"Oh, God, how had that old witch looked at Mortimer?"
"Don't think about it, Eleanor. Just don't think about it. Or about Basta, or his gun, or Maggie wandering through the wayless wood all alone. I'm sure she's alone. A giant will have stepped on that boy and crushed him by now."
It was a good thing Darius didn't know the silly way her thoughts were getting all mixed up, making the tears start to come all the time.
"Darius,"
Eleanor whispered, for the man built like a wardrobe would certainly be on guard outside the door.
"Darius, it's all up to you. You must raid them back."
Darius shook his head so vigorously that his glasses almost slipped off his nose.
"No, no."
His voice was trembling like a leaf in the wind, and his foot began pumping again as if that stupid mattress were the most important thing in the world. Then, very suddenly, he stopped and hid his face in his hands.
"You know what will happen,"
Eleanor heard him say in a stifled voice.
You know what will happen to them if I read with them while I'm afraid."
Eleanor sighed. Yes, she knew. Distorted faces, stiff legs, a lost voice. And of course he was afraid. Probably even more afraid than she was, for Darius had known Mortola and Basta considerably longer.
"Yes, yes, I know. All right,"
she murmured and began abstractedly straightening a few cans on the shelves. Tomato sauce, ravioli, not a particularly nice brand. Red kidney beans. Mortimer loved red kidney beans.
There it came again, that prickling in her nose. "Very well," she said, turning around resolutely. "Then that Orpheus will have to do it."
How composed and sure of herself she sounded. She was obviously a gifted actress, thought Eleanor. She'd realized that before, back in Capricorn's church when all had seemed lost. Indeed, now that she came to think of it, everything had seemed gloomier then, if anything. Darius stared at her,
bewildered.
"Don't look at me like that, for God's sake," she hissed.
"I don't know how we can make him do it either. Not yet."
She began pacing up and down, between the shelves full of cans and preserving jars.
"He's vain, Darius," she whispered. "Very vain. Did you see how he changed color when he realized that Maggie had done something he's tried and failed to do for years? I'm sure he'd like to ask her."
She stopped suddenly and looked at Darius.
"How she managed it?"
Darius stopped pumping.
"Yes. But Maggie would have to be here herself to tell him that."
They looked at each other.
"That's how we'll do it, Darius," Eleanor whispered. "We'll get Orpheus to bring Maggie back, and then she can read Mortimer and Risa back, too, with the same words he used for her. That ought to work."
She began pacing up and down again like a caged panther in the poem she liked so much, except that the look in her eyes was no longer hopeless. She must lay her plans well. That man Orpheus was clever.
"And so are you, Anna," she said to herself. "Just try it."
She couldn't help it. She started thinking of the way Mortola had looked at Mortimer again. Suppose it was much too late by the time she...
"Oh, stop it!"
Eleanor thrust out her chin, pulled back her shoulders, and marched firmly toward the cellar door. She hammered on the white paneled metal with the flat of her hand.
"Hey!"
she called.
"Hey, you! Wanderer man! Open this door! I have to speak with that man Orpheus at once!"
But nothing stirred on the other side of the door, and Eleanor let her hand drop again. For a moment, she entertained the dreadful thought that the two men had gone and left them alone down here, locked in. "And without so much as a can opener," thought Eleanor. "What a ridiculous way to die, starving among piles of canned food." She was just raising both hands to hammer on the door again when she heard footsteps outside. Footsteps going away up the stairs leading from the cellar to the entrance hall.
"Hey!"
she shouted so loudly that Darius, standing behind her, jumped.
"Great wardrobe! Open this door! I want to talk to Orpheus!"
But all was quiet on the other side of the door. Eleanor fell to her knees in front of it. She felt Darius come up beside her and put a hand hesitantly on her shoulder. "He'll be back," he said quietly. "At least they're still here, aren't they?" Then he returned to the air mattress. But Eleanor sat there, her back against the cold cellar door, listening to the silence. You couldn't even hear the birds down here, not the smallest chirp of a cricket. "Maggie will fetch them back," she thought. "Maggie will fetch them back. But suppose by now her mother and father are both..." Oh, not the way to think, Eleanor. Not the way to think. She closed her eyes and heard Darius begin pumping again.
"I'd have sensed it," she thought. "Yes, I would. I'd have sensed it if anything had happened to them. It said so in all the stories. And surely they can't all be lying."
Chapter 25. The Camp in the Forest. Risa didn't know how long she'd been sitting there, just sitting in the dimly lit, dark cave, where the strolling player slept, holding Mo's hand. One of the women players brought her something to eat, and now and then one of the children crept in, leaned against the cave wall, and listened to what she was telling Mo in a quiet voice. About Maggie and Eleanor, Darius, the library and its books, the workshop where he cured books of sickness and wounds as bad as his own. How strange the strolling players must find her stories of another world that they had never seen. And how very strange they must think her, to talk to someone who lay so still, his eyes closed as if he would never open them again. Just as the fifth white woman appeared on the steps, the old woman had returned to Capricorn's fortress with three men. It had not been very far for her to go. Risa had seen guards standing among the trees as they entered the camp. The people these men were guarding were the cripples and the old folk. women with small children, and obviously there were also some in the camp who were simply resting from the stress and strain of life on the open road. When Risa asked where food and clothing for all these people came from, one of the strolling players who had come to fetch Mo replied, "From the prince." And when she asked what prince he meant, he had put a black stone into her hand by way of an answer. She was known as Nettle, the old woman who had so suddenly appeared at the gate of Capricorn's fortress. Everyone treated her with respect, but a little fear was mingled with it, too. Risa had to help her when she cauterized Mo's wound. She still felt sick when she thought of it. Then she had helped the old woman to bind up the wound again, and had memorized all her directions.
"If he's still breathing in 3 days' time, he may live,"
she had said before leaving them alone again, in the cave that offered protection from wild beasts, the sun, and the rain, but not from fear or from black, despairing thoughts. 3 days. It grew dark, and then light again outside. Light, and then dark again. And every time Nettle came back and bent over Mo, Risa sought her face desperately for some sign of hope. But the old woman's features remained expressionless. The days went by, and Mo was still breathing. But he still wouldn't open his eyes. The cave smelled of mushrooms, the brownie's favorite food. Very likely a whole pack of them had once lived there. Now the mushroom aroma mingled with the scent of dead leaves. The strolling players had strewn the cold floor of the cave with them. Dead leaves and fragrant herbs. Thyme, meadow sweet, woodruff. Risa rubbed the dry leaves between her fingers as she sat there cooling Mo's forehead, which was not cold anymore, but hot, terribly hot. The scent of thyme reminded her of a fairy tale he had read to her long, long ago, before he found out that his voice could bring someone like Capricorn out of the words on the page. "Wild thyme should not be brought indoors," the story had said. "Bad luck comes with it." Risa threw away the hard stems and brushed the scent off her fingers onto her dress. One of the women brought her something to eat again and sat beside her for a while, in silence, as if hoping that her presence would bring a little comfort. Soon after that, three of the men came in too, but they stayed standing at the entrance of the cave, looking at her and Mo from a distance. They whispered to each other as they glanced at the pair of them.
"Are we welcome here?"
Risa asked Nettle on one of her silent visits.
"I think they're talking about us."
"Let them," was all the old woman said. "I told them you were attacked by footpads, but of course that doesn't satisfy them. A beautiful woman, a man with a strange wound. Where do they come from? What happened? They're curious. And if you're wise, you won't let too many of them see that scar on his arm."
"Why not?"
Risa looked at her baffled. The old woman scrutinized her as if she wanted to see into her heart.
"Well, if you really don't know, then that's just as well," she said at last. "And let them talk. What else are they to do? Some come here to wait for death, others for life to begin at last. Others again live only on the stories they're told. Tightrope walkers, fire eaters, peasants, princes, they're all the same. Flesh and blood, and a heart that knows it will stop beating one day."
Fire eaters. Risa's heart leaped when Nettle mentioned them. Of course. Why had she thought of it before?
"Please,"
she said when the old woman reached the entrance of the cave again.
"You must know many strolling players. Is there one who calls himself Dustfinger?"
Nettle turned as slowly as if she were still deciding whether to answer this.
"Dustfinger,"
she finally replied, in unforthcoming tones.
"You'll scarcely find one of the strolling players who doesn't know him, but no one's seen him for years. Although,
There are rumors that he's back.
Oh, yes, he's back, thought Risa, and he will help me just as I helped him in the other world. I must send him a message. She heard the desperation in her own voice. Please?
Nettle looked at her without any expression on her brown face.
Cloud Dancer is here, she said at last. His leg is aching again, but as soon as it's better, he'll be on his way. See if he'll ask around for you and deliver your message.
Then she had gone. Cloud Dancer. Darkness was falling again outside. And with the fading light, men, women, and children came into the cave and lay down on the dead leaves to sleep, away from her, as if Mo's stillness might be catching. One of the women brought her a torch. It cast quivering shadows on the rocky walls, shadows that made faces and passed black fingers over Mo's pallid face. The fire did not keep the white women away, although it was said that they both desired and feared it. They appeared in the cave again and again. Like pale reflections with faces made of mist, they came closer and disappeared again, presumably driven away by the sharp and bitter smell of the leaves that Nettle had scattered around the place where Mo was lying.
It will keep them off, the old woman had said, but you must watch carefully all the same.
One of the children was crying in his sleep. His mother stroked his hair to comfort him, and Risa couldn't help thinking of Maggie. Was she alone, or was the boy still with her? Was she happy, sad, sick, in good health? How often she had asked herself these questions, as if she hoped for an answer sometime. From somewhere. A woman brought her fresh water. She smiled gratefully and asked the woman about Cloud Dancer.
He prefers to sleep in the open, she said, pointing.
It was some time since Risa had seen any more white women. But all the same, she woke one of the women who had offered to relieve her during the night. Then she climbed over the sleeping figures and went out. The moon was shining through the dense canopy of leaves, brighter than any torch. A few men were sitting around a fire. Unsure of herself, Risa went toward them in the dress that wasn't right for this place at all. It ended too far above her ankles, even for one of the strolling players. And it was torn, too. The men stared at her, both suspicious and curious.
Is one of you Cloud Dancer?
A thin little man, toothless and probably not nearly as old as he looked, nudged the man sitting next to him in the ribs.
Why'd you ask?
This man's face was friendly, but his eyes were wary.
Nettle says he might carry a message for me.
A message? To who?
He stretched his left leg, rubbing the knee as if it hurt him.
To a fire eater. Dustfinger is his name? His face?
Cloud Dancer drew one finger over his cheek.
Three scars. I know. What'd you want with him?
I want you to take him this.
Risa kneeled down by the fire and put her hand into the pocket of her dress. She always had paper and pencil with her. They had done duty as her tongue for years. Now her voice was back, but a wooden tongue was more useful for sending Dustfinger a message. Fingers trembling, she began to write, taking no notice of the suspicious eyes following her hand as if she were doing something forbidden.
"She can write," remarked the toothless man. There was no mistaking the disapproval in his tone.
It was a long, long time ago that Risa had sat in the marketplaces of towns on the far side of the forest, dressed in men's clothes, and with her hair cut short, because writing was the only way she knew how to earn her living. And writing was a craft forbidden to women in this world. Slavery was the punishment for it, and it had made her Mortola's slave. For it was Mortola who had discovered Risa's disguise. And as a reward, she was allowed to take her away to Capricorn's fortress.
Dustfinger won't be able to read that, pointed out Cloud Dancer equably.
Yes, he will. I taught him how.
They looked at her incredulously. Letters. Mysterious things. Rich men's tools. Not meant for strolling players, and certainly not for women. Only Cloud Dancer smiled.
Well, imagine that. Dustfinger can read, he said softly. Fine, but I can't. You better tell me what you've written so that I can tell him the words even if your note gets lost, which can easily happen with written words much more easily than with words in your head.
Risa looked Cloud Dancer straight in the face.
You trust people far too easily.
How often Dustfinger had told her that, but what choice did she have now? In a low voice, she repeated what she had written. Dear Dustfinger, I'm in the Strolling Players' camp with Mo, deep in the Wayless Wood. Mortola and Basta brought us here, and Mortola... Her voice failed as she said it. Mortola shot Mo. Maggie is here, too. I don't know exactly where, but please look for her and bring her to me. Protect her as you try to protect me. But beware of Basta. Risa.
Mortola? Wasn't that what they called the old woman who lived with the fire razors?
The man who asked this question had no right hand. A thief. You lost your left hand for stealing a loaf, your right hand for a piece of meat.
Yes, they say she's poisoned more men than the Arrowhead has hairs on his head. And it was Basta who slashed Dustfinger's face all that time ago. He won't like to hear those two names.
But Basta's dead, remarked the toothless minstrel. And they've been saying the same about the old woman, too.
That's what they tell the children, said a man with his back to Risa. So they'll sleep better. The likes of Mortola don't die. They only bring death to others.
They're not going to help me, thought Risa. Not now they've heard those two names.
The only one looking at her in anything like a friendly way was a man wearing the black and red of a fire eater. But Cloud Dancer was still inspecting her as if he wasn't sure what to make of her, her and her mysterious message. Finally, however, without a word, he took the note from her fingers and put it in the bag he wore at his belt.
Very well. I'll take Dustfinger your message, he said. I know where he is.
He was going to help her after all. Risa could hardly believe it. Oh, thank you.
Swaying with exhaustion, she straightened up again.
When do you think you'll get the message?
Cloud Dancer patted his knee.
My leg must get better first.
Of course.
Risa bit back the words she wanted to shout, begging him to hurry. She mustn't press him too hard, or he might change his mind, and then who would find Dustfinger for her? A piece of wood broke apart in the flames, spitting out glowing sparks at her feet.
I have no money to pay you, she said. But perhaps you'll accept this?
And she took her wedding ring off her finger and offered it to Cloud Dancer. The toothless man looked at the gold ring as avidly as if he would like to put his own hand out for it, but Cloud Dancer shook his head.
No, no, forget it, he said. Your husband is sick. It's bad luck to give away your wedding ring, I've heard.
Bad luck. Risa was quick to put the ring back on her finger.
Yes, she murmured. Yes, you're right. Thank you. Thank you with all my heart.
She turned to go.
Hey, you!
The minstrel whose back had been turned to her was looking at her. He had only two fingers on his right hand.
Your husband. He has dark hair, dark as the fur of a mole, and he's tall. Very tall.
Bewildered, Risa looked at him. So?
And then there's the scar, just where the songs say. I've seen it. Everyone knows how he got it. The Adderhead's dogs bit him there when he was poaching near the Castle of Night, and he took a stag, one of the white stags that only the Adderhead himself may kill.
What on earth was she talking about? Risa remembered what Nettle had said. And if you're wise, you won't let too many of them see that scar on his arm. The toothless man laughed.
Listen to Two Fingers, would you? He thinks it's the blue jay lying there in the cave. Since when did you believe in old wives' tales? Was he wearing his feathered mask?
How should I know? Snapped Two Fingers. Did I bring him here? But I tell you, that's him.
Risa sensed that the Fire Eater was examining her thoughtfully.
I don't know what you're talking about, she said. I don't know any blue jay.
You don't?
Two Fingers picked up the lute lying on the grass beside him. Risa had never before heard the song that he now sang in a soft voice.